I think design emerged as a sort of a hero, as a discipline in the pandemic. I think design really came to the fore and showed what it is capable of in a crisis.
That's Priya Kanchandani, and this is the On Design podcast. Hi everyone, and welcome to a new episode of the On Design podcast. I'm your host, Justina Green. How are you doing? I haven't asked you that for a while, actually, and I hope you're doing well. It's a bit mad, in my opinion, that this year is slowly coming to an end, but maybe it's a good thing too. So I hope you're keeping well, you're inspired, and you're staying creative as well. And I'm over the moon today to bring you a conversation with Priya Kanchandani, who's the head of curatorial and interpretation at the Design Museum. And she's amazing. Prior to her role at the Design Museum, she worked at the V&A as well as the British Council. And before that, she studied modern languages at the University of Cambridge and had a five-year career as a lawyer before moving to the design industry. She is incredible. And I found our conversation absolutely fascinating, and we touched on important topics such as increasing diversity in the design sector, but not only through press-friendly commissions, but importantly through regular commercial work for designers from diverse backgrounds. We also talked about the role of design in the pandemic and curating museum exhibitions remotely. So here it is. Enjoy our conversation.
Excited to have you here and have you as part of this season, which we were just chatting about, kind of the all-female lineup. And as I was doing research for our conversation, I didn't even know where to start kind of speaking to you, because the it's so incredibly impressive what you've done in design sector already. And to think that you've had careers before design, that just blew my mind. And so I thought, you know, you did earned your degree in languages, you had a career as a lawyer, and I really wanted to find out what your early path was and what made you enter design.
Yeah, I have had quite a varied career. I know that's quite unusual, but for me, that's just a natural way of thinking. I don't really think that much in terms of disciplines. I think that disciplines are something we've kind of imposed onto a way of thinking, but the brain is actually a lot more fluid, at least it is for me. I think I also just have quite varied interests, but then they have strange points of intersection, I found, and I just feel that, yeah, the interdisciplinary way of being just suits me and really stretches my mind and enables me to bring sort of like maybe sometimes different ways of looking at something. But it's also partly because I think when I, you know, finished my A-levels and I was going to university, I was, you know, you're quite young at that time, you're like 18 years old and you're supposed to make a decision about what you're going to do for the rest of your life. And I don't think I really had a clear vision. I think I deep down had like a desire to work in the cultural sector. I was fascinated by galleries, museums, and by the visual arts. But I just didn't see myself reflected, I think, in those sectors. And it just seemed so unattainable that I'd ever have a career in those fields or in the media or anything like that. So I think I did what I was interested in, which was languages. I grew up speaking different Indian languages. And I think it's just something that I took to, and I always loved words. I always read a lot. I loved books and poetry, doing a languages degree just felt like an amazing way to have access to other places and cultures, and of course have an excuse to live abroad, which I always wanted to do, and I got to live for a year in Italy. It's actually in Italy, where I was working as a legal translator, that I first started getting interested in design. I actually lived with a design journalist. She was like over a decade older, and just her life seemed very cool, and she would take me to Salone del Mobile in those days, which was a lot smaller an affair, in the Fuori Salone, which was nothing like it is now. This is in like the early noughties, but it was still just such a gem of an event, and I was just very fascinated by it. but sort of plodding away with my legal translating work, which is paying my bills. And then I was offered the chance of a training contract with the law firm, and I wasn't sure if that was what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. I did a couple more law internships, and I think I just naturally am quite analytical probably as a person, and it was something that kind of came to me that didn't seem, it wasn't hugely challenging maybe, I don't know. And I just kind of slipped into this career path where I was offered a training contract. And at that time, it was very lucrative. I was given a letter with my first 4-year salary before I'd even started, like a year before I'd even started working. So I felt like this was an offer I couldn't refuse. And I went on and did a 2-year equivalent of a law degree. And I started working at a firm called Clifford Chance, like a magic circle law firm, where I met amazing people. I worked in different countries. I worked in Milan. I went on secondment to National Council of Civil Liberties, which was run by Shami Chakravarti at the time. So I just had so many opportunities to do interesting things. And I just soaked it all up and had a really great time in my early 20s. But I think at that time, I started to feel those things that previously felt unattainable, started to feel like, actually, you know, if I could do this, then why could I not have tried to pursue my passions and my interests? And I'd spend my evenings reading a lot and trying to, I guess, find out what those interests were. And I knew about this MA in design history at the V&A, joint with the RCA. I'd known about it since I was at university. But, you know, it was quite expensive to be a postgrad in London for 2 years, no guarantee of a job at the end of it. And it just felt something that was difficult to attain. But I think after working in the law firm, it just gave me a lot more confidence and financial stability. And that gives you confidence in itself to be able to do the things that you're really driven by. And I think I was 27, and by then I'd been working in law firms for 5 years, and I'd had 2 degrees under my belt, and I just thought it's kind of now or never. And so I applied to the Courtauld, and I applied to the RCA, and I could not believe it when I got a place, because it just felt like something so removed from what I was doing, and I didn't know if I'd ever have a place there or be accepted. So when I got a place, yeah, it was amazing. It was just like a dream come true, I think. And I started at the RCA, and I basically completely threw myself into the whole world. So I started doing the course, and I started writing about design very early on for different blogs. And, you know, at that time, a magazine called Disegno was just started. And I had that was my first publication. I think it was based on one of the essays I did at the RCA. And then I did various placements in the V&A. I tried to help out on exhibitions and research projects if I could. And I basically never looked back. And then when I finished the course, I think I just wanted to stay at the V&A forever. It was just my favorite place on earth. I was just so encapsulated by it. It has this incredible history and collection, and I just met very interesting people, and it was just such an energetic time when the postmodernism exhibition was on while I was studying. My tutors Jane Pavitt and Glenn Adamson were the curators, so that they were amazing role models for me, and they're so intellectually incredible, as well as being brilliant teachers, that I really looked up to them. And then the David Bowie exhibition opened, which was one of the most successful exhibitions in the history of museums. And it was not just about the content, which of course was really amazing, but it was the experience of being in that exhibition and seeing the space come to life and the music and the objects. So I think that was a really magical time. And then after that was the Alexander McQueen show. You know, so it didn't really get better in terms of like museum history. This was like the pinnacle. So I think that really excited me, and it made me feel like this is where I could grow a career in this sector and share ideas with audiences in exciting ways. So I kind of wanted, so that's sort of how it started.
So when you got onto kind of to your course to RCA, was it immediately that you felt this is where I belong and this is what I want to do?
I think I had that sense for the first time in my first degree. When I studied languages at Cambridge, I found Cambridge, I met some of, you know, my lifelong friends there, but I found the way of being a little archaic. It didn't always relate to the methods of teaching and so on. But there was a course that I did that was Renaissance studies, and it was more visual art focused, but it was actually very much about design thinking. It was about looking at, like, we'd look at a Medici painting, but it wasn't just about it as an art object, but it as a designed object. So, you know, how was it commissioned? What is it made of? What is its materiality? Where was it hung? What does its context say about it? So it was that sort of way of thinking, I think, that I was really fascinated by. And it was the tutor on that course, I think, who's a talented teacher called Matthew Traherne, who just made this whole world very exciting. And it just seemed, like a way of thinking that I could get on board with. And it sort of carried through, I think, to when I went to the RCA and learned about reading objects in that sort of more three-dimensional way.
That's fascinating that there was that thread of design thinking was already there with your first degree. And your upbringing, did that influence your early desire to enter the culture sector?
I grew up in a place which I sometimes describe as a cultural void. I grew up in Luton, which is a town just outside London. There aren't really any museums or galleries of note, and the museums that there are were quite fusty. They didn't really interest me at all. But it was actually my dad who has a sort of, I guess, secret passion in some ways for art, who took us to museums and galleries on the weekends, on day trips. So I think we were really lucky to have access to that from a very young age. So he'd take us to the British Museum to see the mummies, or but then as we got older, he took us to art exhibitions. And I remember going, I remember seeing the Anish Kapoor installation in Tate Turbine Hall when Tate first opened, and just being completely wowed by that, and feeling like this was a really powerful space that can change the way that people think.
And you've mentioned that in the early days, the maybe entering the culture sector or the media didn't feel attainable. Why was that for you?
I think it was a combination of things. I think maybe being from an immigrant family, my grandparents came over to the UK after the partition of India, and they were refugees from Pakistan, and they kind of lost everything. And it was my granddad's dream to leave his village where, you know, no one in his family had been literate before him, and to become a doctor, which was a huge, huge ambition. So I think for my family, the idea of doing something that wasn't about financial security was quite foreign. Mm. That sort of must have fed into my desire to pursue a secure career path early on. But of course, they earned a great deal of privilege that I benefited from, and enabled me to do well in my education and, you know, go to university and then later choose the career that I was interested in. So there was that. But yeah, I guess there was a sort of thing about what growing up in a working class town. And I think this sort of aspiration that I secretly had just felt too big. It didn't necessarily feel like it was allowed, you know, that it was realistic. It was unrealistic. And then there was, definitely ethnically, when you don't see yourself reflected in those roles, I think it definitely makes a difference to your perception of who you can or can't become.
And was that why you co-founded Museum Detox Initiative?
Yeah, so I think when I started working at the V&A, you know, a group of us came together, initiated by Zara Wajid, who's now director of Birmingham Museums, but at that time was working at Greenwich, I think. And we just got together in a pub and started talking about this issue of representation and the lack thereof in the museums where we worked. And I think it was the seed of a new way of thinking that has now obviously become much more prevalent, but this was in around 2013, where I think the word decolonizing hadn't yet taken root. We were still talking about like post-colonial thinking, and it was a different generation, but we knew that we wanted change. So that was at the forefront of our minds. And yeah, we started coming together, you know, as insiders and outsiders, because we were sort of activists, but part of the institutions that we wanted mm-hmm. to change, which is, you know, quite slightly unsettling place to be. But we, yeah, somehow people, I think there was a sense that more broadly that this change was needed, and we were able to have a voice in a way that, you know, we didn't necessarily expect, and then found ourselves years on then being listened to by those institutions that we initially wanted to circumvent. So it's quite an interesting journey.
And where do you think, kind of compared to say in the last decade, how has the museum sector evolved in that area?
That's a good question. I think that the word evolved is interesting because it suggests change in a positive direction. I would say that there's definitely change in terms of awareness. So I think when we were talking about this issue, there wasn't like a conscious awareness that this was a problem, that not universally anyway. But I think in the last 5 years, that's changed a lot. I think there's, yeah, a concerted effort now made to acknowledge the problem, and to talk about it and to be open about that, which is really positive. I think the question is, how does that manifest itself? Mm. I think, yeah, it's not necessarily easy for institutions that have inherited the legacy of colonialism, that their entire collections might be founded based on oppression and racial oppression that went on for generations. So how do you undo that? It's not going to change overnight, that's for sure. But I do think there is like a new generation of museum workers who are pushing for change, and every inch that they gain kind of adds up, and we can really see the difference that's making in small ways now.
So do you feel like we haven't evolved yet? We're at the awareness stage and there's a long way ahead.
Yeah, I think we're at the awareness stage. I think we're on the cusp. There is a feeling that we're on the cusp. I think the visual arts world has kind of shown that it's possible. There are institutions like Serpentine. If you go to the Serpentine in the summer, you know, all three exhibitions are by people of colour, which I don't think I've never seen in history, which is, that signals an amazing shift. I think that, yeah, museums and the design sector maybe have further to go.
Do you think some of it is because of how big of institutions they are, that the changes happen slowly?
I don't think so, because I came from, you know, I worked as a lawyer and worked in big institutions, and my clients were huge financial institutions. And actually they were quite quick to change. I think often bigger institutions actually have more resources, which enables them to be able to change. But I think it's actually a more deep-rooted problem, and that's to do with like a pipeline at a sort of more grassroots level, which hasn't been cultivated for generations. So I think these were sort of spaces of privilege for such a long time that problem of, you know, young people from diverse backgrounds not seeing themselves reflected has sort of created a sort of lacuna, sort of vacuum that is taking time to fill. But I feel hopeful. I think since BLM came to a head last year, I think there's a sort of a renewed urgency that we need to deal with this issue more quickly and Yeah, there's definitely positive change, and we can see that in programming, in new appointments that are being made. There are signs of positive change.
And talking of positive change, you're also part of the Design Can collective that has been going for a few years now. And I was wondering if you can tell the listeners more about it and what it aims to achieve.
Yeah, so Design Can was sort of the brainchild of Zettler. And I joined from the beginning on the steering committee. And we kind of came together with the aim of sort of, I guess, campaigning to diversify the design sector. I'm sure it'll be no surprise to anyone listening that, you know, the design sector is probably one of the least diverse sectors in the creative industries. Unfortunately, it's been quite slow to change. And I think the comparison of the visual arts sort of highlights that. But it's design and architecture too. And we decided to come together to, yeah, campaign the design sector to change. And we've done a few different initiatives. Actually, during London Design Festival this year, we're doing a mentorship project at the V&A that's been curated by Manisha Keele, who's the festival's curator there. And I guess the aim is to try to change things inch by inch. I think we were at the stage of, I think we started out as a sort of campaigning project, and now we kind of want to shift gear and try to actually encourage the sector to implement these ideas in more concrete ways. So that's sort of what the aim is. I think the response has been amazing, and, you know, Zettler would be able to tell us a bit more about that, but I think supporting the social media, I think signing up to some of the objectives to Design Can in the manifesto on the webpage, I really urge anyone listening to do those things.
And we'll include links as well in show notes so that people can head to the manifestos and sign up right after this podcast.
Yeah, I mean, the manifesto is really powerful. It's about, you know, it says, design can be more representative of the world it serves. Design can be industry for people of all backgrounds, abilities, ages, and identities. Design can be stronger with the talent that has been ignored for too long. And design can disrupt the status quo, celebrate new voices, and tell untold stories. So that's sort of the urgent language that we need to be talking about this issue with. Again, I just hope the design sector listens, because frankly, I'm quite frustrated by the lack of change that I see in the industry.
Because it's really interesting, I think, you know, what we're getting to here, that is that the things are changing, but there's awareness, there's campaigning, but then there are actual changes to be made that are long term that maybe are not happening yet. So there are so many stages, and it really is getting to that stage of it being implemented, isn't it?
I think the risk with these types of issues, and when they start out, was certainly the case for us with the beginning of Museum Detox, is the idea of the echo chamber. So it's sort of who is willing to listen. But I think the audience that is willing to listen has grown. And I think even commercially now, there's renewed pressure on design brands to be willing to engage with this issue. But unfortunately, as a journalist, when I was editor of Icon, and I'd often be briefed by design brands or design festivals, and the number of times I'd been briefed and they were only white men involved with a project was many, many times, the majority of times. And it was frankly abysmal that I had to actively ask, where are the women in this project, or where are the people of diverse backgrounds? And the fact that, yeah, that you then feel that you're a problem by asking those questions shows the degree to which we haven't changed.
And what kind of answers would you get?
I think PRs started to become more aware around that time that this is a problem, and they have been quite good at then probing the brands that they're working with and encouraging them to include more diverse lineups in the future in their projects. But I did find that challenging. But I think as a journalist, there were two ways I could deal with it. One was by highlighting the problem, and the other was by decreasing the level of exposure. And I think that speaks for itself, and brands that listen. But yeah, unfortunately, if you look at the big design brands and which designers they commission, which names they promote, I think there are a handful now of ethnic minority designers who are have started to gain more traction than the brands going to again and again. But I feel it can be a bit tokenistic, and to just work with those designers repeatedly, it frankly is a bit lazy. I think that the design industry needs to take responsibility for growing that talent at a more nascent stage. So commissioning emerging designers from diverse backgrounds and helping them to grow their careers, so they can hold their own alongside those big names that they've been commissioning for decades. I don't know what you think. You've been working with the design industry for a long time, so I'm sure you know what I mean.
I know exactly what you mean, yes. And it's about seeing what's next, I think. Because, like you say, it can be seen as a good step. But because I've worked in PR as well for a long time, like for a decade, I think, before doing what I do now. And I can see the PR in it often, or the idea of why people might be doing it. And so I think it's looking at brands or institutions where you can see it's part of their DNA. It's just how they are, rather than a marketing nod to whatever is happening right now, whatever feels urgent now. I think it'll really be about what we see happening in years to come, mm-hmm. and how festivals, exhibitions, panel discussions, how all of them will evolve.
Yeah, definitely. I think the crux of it is product design, because I think product design reaches consumers in like vast numbers, and products tend to be designed by named designers who have built a reputation. And I think there are other areas of design that's starting to change. Like graphic design, for example, is becoming quite diverse, and they're different forms of expression and representation. But yeah, I'd love to see like a chair in mass manufacture that is not by a white designer.
Here's a challenge.
Yeah, like I'd love anyone who's listening to make that happen. Or if they feel I'm wrong, then please send me some names, because I'd love to know more of them. But frankly, yeah, because I'm actually, I've been doing it at my home recently, and I've never actually been a designer myself, so this is the closest I've got to, actually designing a space. And yeah, frankly, it's disappointing when you actually get to the practicalities of a product, of a thing, of a chair, of a bed, of a whatever it is, a chaise. I think it really highlights how the problem. So I think there's a lot at the moment. There's a language at the moment of, oh well, we've come so far since last summer, or but we already have an anti-racism statement. We're already changing our recruitment policies. But I think until I see that tangible difference, it's not enough, basically.
But I think this is a really good point you've raised, because there's a question as well about not only what it looks like to the consumer on the outside, as in who's on the panel, who's at the exhibition, but also where are all the commercial transactions happening? Because these might be really two very different things. Because to commission a one-off installation that will be in press is one thing, but to work with a designer over many years on products that go to consumers, where that's a big commercial project, that's a completely different thing.
Exactly, and that's what I'm interested in now. I'm not interested in the optics of it now. I think we're past that. Who you have on a panel discussion is great, but who are you commissioning? Like who is making the money out of this? Like who's
that's a brilliant point. No, that's really, really brilliant point. And something.
And next time you do a podcast and it's with one of the big design brands, I love that question to be put to them.
Yeah, that would never get through their PR, you see.
Well, that in itself would be revealing, I think.
That's true as well. Yeah. And I was thinking as well, I would really love to hear your thoughts on the pandemic, of course, because we can't have an interview without mentioning the pandemic, but really pandemic from the design perspective. And where do you think design really helped and where it's fallen short in terms of being useful during the pandemic?
I think design emerged as a sort of a hero, as a discipline. In the pandemic, I think design really came to the fore and showed what it is capable of in a crisis. That design is not just about, you know, pretty dresses and, you know, nice furniture, which is great. It has its place. But I think design was able to show that it can be a tool to help us adapt to really challenging circumstances. And that was the case across the board. So it applied to PPE. You know, fashion brands were able to step up and manufacture PPE in quantities that government supply chains just weren't able to keep up with. There was, in terms of engineering, there were partnerships between designers and engineers to manufacture ventilators, which was pretty incredible. These life-saving devices that wouldn't, you know, that we had a massive shortage of during the pandemic. There were collectives of designers that I think designers, because they're very adaptive and they can work in different ecosystems, they were able to change their supply chains in order to enable them to make PPE in new networks. So for example, the Emergency Designer Network, the supply chain, I remember interviewing them during the pandemic, and it was just incredible how they brought together not just the group of designers, but they had amassed, you know, a supplier for the fabric. They had got in touch with the dry cleaner who could help them with like the cleaning and the deliveries. And they had created this whole chain, this whole mini economy for the creation of PPE that directly went to the hospital. So it skipped out any kind of middleman or like government infrastructure, which was amazing. So I think, you know, there was also sort of communication around the pandemic that I think where the graphic design really aided. So, for example, the symbol for the COVID itself that sort of presented it, you know, this ball with the sort of spikes protruding from it, sort of presented the pandemic as something that we can't ignore at a time where people weren't necessarily taking it seriously. And I think that sort of graphic identity really held its own, and it sort of unified everybody in the face of this thing that was very hard to define. I was very proud to be able to, yeah, I don't know if that's the right way of saying it, but you can be proud of design, but I think design really came into its own. I wrote a piece at the time for The Guardian, I think it was last August, making a case for why, yeah, design had been an instrument to save people's lives, which had some really lovely responses to it. But I think also the project that Brendan Cormier has done at the V&A, Pandemic Objects, is really fantastic. And it sort of uses the objects and material culture of the pandemic to tell stories about the way in which we've been living and how the pandemic changed our way of life, which is another whole level of looking, a new other level of looking at it that is, I think, is really interesting.
And that's fascinating, isn't it? Because we'll see these objects and they'll be very familiar to us. But then, of course, we don't know what will happen in years to come. And we're like, you know, we might have other pandemics, etc. But it might be that in years to come, people will be looking back at the COVID pandemic and those objects. And there'll be history. Yeah. There'll be, you know, like the objects from the past that we look at now.
Exactly. I think like there are objects that we always lived with, but we will never look at them in the same way. Mm-hmm. I think that has been captured really in really interesting ways through design discourse. So the idea of baking, for example, as a craft, we'll never look at in the same way. It will be, you know, remembered by entire generations through the guise of the pandemic. And I think the idea of the painted rainbow that children paint at school, yeah, or, you know, it was a rainbow, but I think it has like a renewed meaning now. The idea of the rainbow is a, yeah, sort of something that was a tribute to the NHS and to the doctors, the workforce of the NHS that served us in, you know, really precarious times. So I think that whole visual material culture, the iconography, the craft, the journeys and stories around them, I think will be one of the most incredible legacies in design terms of this period.
And now we're talking about museum collections in a way that they're accessible and we can visit a museum, but we can't forget that as you were already at Design Museum, how long was the period that the museum had to be shut for?
It's really hard to remember the exact number of weeks and months now, but I was meant to start last spring at the Design Museum, but delayed my start date when the pandemic came into full effect and the lockdown, and I didn't start until the beginning of August, which was just over a year ago at the time we're recording. It was a very strange time to start working at a public facing institution when the public can't enter the building. Obviously we had to close some of our exhibitions, which is always heartbreaking when people have worked so hard and created such incredible content. You know, we had Electronic Music and Designs of the Year, which were both really incredible shows. So it was a very strange time, but on the flip side, I think there was a real sense of kind of camaraderie, people coming together, even though it was online. And I think we just kind of got through it. One thing about museums is you're always working several years ahead. So I actually started working on an exhibition that will open in November this year. So I basically was thinking in the future in a sense, and I had to try and imagine this future where actually people would just be able to go in and out of the museum freely. We won't be worried so much about how many people will be in the gallery at one time. So we were trying to imagine this future at a really surreal time, which is obviously not an easy thing to do for the team.
Yeah, that must be really hard. Yes, because you're going through many things in personal life as well, because there's the personal way of coping with what's happening. Then you're starting a new job, so you're meeting everybody on Zoom, online, so you're not building those connections. It's so much harder to exchange ideas as well, because you don't have the serendipity of just stumbling up on something or having a chat with a person and the ideas coming through. Yet exactly. You want to put together your first exhibition, you want to make it fantastic, and from what you told me before we recorded, because I know the exhibition is still a secret, it's going to be pretty amazing as well.
Yeah, I think it was challenging. And, you know, we have these weekly team meetings in the curatorial department. And we kind of run through all of the exhibitions and any issues or thoughts. We share them at this meeting. And I remember logging on to, you know, one of the meetings, and I think it was during the winter lockdown. And everyone's face has just kind of said it all. I think everyone has, you know, worked so hard and there's so much uncertainty ahead. It was very difficult to just have this regular meeting. And I remember saying, okay, everyone, it's okay to feel this way. And we all went round and I kind of said, you know, does everyone want to just say something that they miss? And we all just kind of, we all said something, and it was really wonderful and that, you know, we were able to do that. And that was it. We just decided we couldn't have like our regular meeting. Everyone needed to just let loose a little. Mm. But then conversely, just the other week, we were able to have a meeting in which everyone said something that we really love, like why we do this job. And many of the stories were about reopening, you know, the idea of seeing the Perrion show actually open after everyone working on it in a pandemic for so long. The idea of seeing queue outside the museum and seeing people milling around for the first time. was like, it was like a really amazing breakthrough and really energizing.
That's incredible. And now you have a full autumn winter season ahead, and hopefully no more lockdowns looming. So do you want to tell me about everything that's coming up? That's not a secret.
So, you know, we've got our autumn program kicking off very soon. So we've got an exhibition about waste called Waste Age, which is really exciting and really timely, I think. And then we've got an exhibition that is a secret, which I'll be able to tell you more about soon, which I've been curating for the past year on the down low. And then we've got next year's program, which is really exciting. I think it's really interesting because it kind of looks at the world through the lens of design in multiple different levels. So there's like a more kind of, I guess, conventional design show that's about Irma Boom, the amazing book designer. She's really fantastic. And that will be next autumn. And then we've got a show that's sort of, I guess it's like around, it's more of a philosophical movement. It's about surrealism in design, which is really fantastic. And it'll have some design classics and some more unexpected show pieces in there. And that's based on a show that's from Vitra. And then we have got a show that's about more about touch and tactility, which I think is a really interesting subject at the moment post-pandemic. And that's Weird Sensation Feels Good, which is a show that's developed by Arctes and in partnership with them. And then finally, we've got a new show, which is more about, I guess, the intersection between popular culture and design, which is a really fascinating line to tread, I think. And it's about football. It's called Football Designing the World's Game. So that's going to be our Gallery One show next spring, which is really exciting.
So a very, very diverse lineup of ideas. And like you said, the exhibition focus on touch and the tactile feelings. That's something that I think we all have missed.
Exactly. So that show is about, it's basically an exhibition about ASMR, mm-hmm. which I'm sure many people will know about. But it's sort of, I guess it's a digital movement. But, you know, Arctes experimented with it in an exhibition context quite successfully. And we've decided to sort of expand on that and bring it to a London audience, which I'm really excited about.
That sounds really, really cool. So that's next year. Lots of things. And also, like I mentioned before we started to talk, that when this podcast is out, you would have told us what the secret exhibition is.
Yeah.
So exactly. Where there is the intro and the outro, the audience will know and we'll be all very, very excited. And to wrap up our conversation, I just wanted to ask you more of a personal question. And how has the pandemic been for you? We know now that you've changed jobs and you've worked kind of in the pandemic on an exhibition opening in real life. How have you experienced it? What the past 2 years have been like for you? And what do you hope for kind of in years to come?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's been a real double-edged sword. I think in some ways it's been one of the darkest times of our lives. You know, people have lost their lives. People have been unwell. I was unwell with COVID last year. It took several months to recover. You know, so it's very hard to say this, you know, that this was a positive experience. But I do think many of us have evolved and taken away new things, new ways of being from this time, this period of greater introspection. And I've definitely done that. I think I have learned to value the idea of home. I think the idea of locality means a lot more. So we've all got to know our local high streets, our local shops, at times when, you know, in a context where we've all been commuting for decades probably, and haven't necessarily invested in our communities, getting to know our neighbours. I think those small things just make such a huge difference to the way that we connect, which is positive. I also feel this sort of balancing in the sense that I, yeah, I was unwell 10 years ago with, less than that, but with ovarian cancer, which was, you know, a life-changing experience. And I think for me, I experienced a lot of the growth and what changed in the way I think about the world that people have experienced now during the lockdown. And I think, yeah, our understanding of illness as a society has changed. I think and I hope there's more empathy when it comes to issues like disability, invisible disability, fatigue. And those were all issues that I had been dealing with since my cancer, and trying to find understanding and empathy. But I sometimes found that quite hard. People were always understanding, but I think it's really hard to connect with those kinds of challenges. And I think the pandemic has, yeah, changed people's awareness of those things.
That's a really beautiful thought to finish with. And thank you so much for sharing kind of about what you've been through as well. And I have been seeing positive changes around people just checking in with each other as well, and actually asking, and kind of the mental health situation and conversation is much more widespread now than it used to be. So I do hope that that continues. And I think you've kind of hit the nail on the head as well with mentioning empathy, that it's, I strongly believe that it kind of starts and ends with empathy. And if we can inject that more into everything that we do and how we are, we can improve the sense of community or belonging, or help each other and help ourselves that way as well. So yeah, thank you so much for your time, Priya. It's just been a fascinating conversation, and I really can't wait to find out more about your first exhibition, your first curated exhibition for the Design Museum, which is super exciting, and we'll be there for Waystage as well.
Amazing. Can't wait to see you there.
Priya has raised so many important points about many issues the design industry is currently facing. And whilst the outlook is positive, you would have found in our conversation that in certain cases we're only scratching the surface. But together, I really hope we can make a difference. And I've included links to the Design Can in the show notes, where you can learn more about how the design industry is actually supporting diversity. And that's all for this episode. And thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure you subscribe to the pod. And as always, you can keep in touch with me as well on Instagram at Justina Green. Bye for now.